to date have been funded by investors, either formally, as in the case of venture-funded enterprises, or informally, as is the case with new products developed within larger corporations. These investors have seen some early successes and now expect to see real progress against the business plan's long-term revenue growth objectives. As we now know, seeking this kind of growth during the chasm period is futile. Nonetheless, it is the commitment in the plan. If the commitment had not been made, the funding would not have been available. And the clock is ticking. Indeed, a truly predatory type of investor, sometimes referred to as a vulture capitalist, looks to use the chasm period of struggle and failure as a means to discredit the current management, thereby driving down the equity value in the company, so that in the next round of funding, he or she has an opportunity to secure dominant control of the company, install a new management team, and, worst case, become the owner of a major technology asset, dirt cheap. This is an incredibly destructive exercise, during which not only the baby and the bathwater, but all human values and winning opportunities are thrown out the window. Nonetheless, it happens. Even investors with reasonable demands and a supportive attitude, however, can be troubled by the chasm. Under the best-case scenario, you are asking them to rein back their expectations, just when it seems most natural to let them fly. There is an underlying feeling that somehow, somewhere, someone has failed. They may be willing to give you the benefit of the doubt for a time, but you don't have any time to waste. You must get into a mainstream market segment soon, establishing long-term relationships with pragmatist buyers, for only through these can you control your own destiny. Fighting your way into the mainstream. To enter the mainstream market is an act of aggression. The companies who have already established relationships with your target customer will resent your intrusion and do everything they can to shut you out. The customers themselves will be suspicious of you as a new and untried player in their marketplace. No one wants your presence. You are an invader. This is not a time to focus on being nice. As we have already said, the perils of the chasm make this a life-or-death situation for you. You must win entry to the mainstream, despite whatever resistance is posed. So, if we are going to be warlike, we might as well be so explicitly. For guidance, we are going to look back to an event in the first half of the 20th century. The Allied invasion of Normandy on D-Day, June 6, 1944. To be sure, there are more current examples of military success, but this particular analogy relates to our specific concerns very well. The comparison is straightforward enough. Our long-term goal is to enter and take control of a mainstream market, Eisenhower's Europe, that is currently dominated by an entrenched competitor, the Axis. For our product to wrest the mainstream market from this competitor, we must assemble an invasion force comprising other products and companies, the Allies. By way of entry into this market, our immediate goal is to transition from an early market base, England, to a strategic target market segment in the mainstream, the beaches at Normandy. Separating us from our goal is the chasm, the English Channel. We are going to cross that chasm as fast as we can with an invasion force focused directly and exclusively on the point of attack, D-Day. Once we force the competitor out of our targeted niche markets, secure the beachhead, then we will move out to take over additional market segments, districts of France, on the way toward overall market domination, the liberation of Europe. That's it. That's the strategy. Replicate D-Day and win entry to the mainstream. Cross the chasm by targeting a very specific niche market where you can dominate from the outset, force your competitors out of that market niche, and then use it as a base for broader operations. Concentrate an overwhelmingly superior force on a highly focused target. It worked in 1944 for the Allies, and it has worked since for any number of high-tech companies. The key to the Normandy advantage, what allows the fledgling enterprise to win over pragmatist customers in advance of broader market acceptance, is focusing an overabundance of support into a confined market niche. By simplifying the initial challenge, the enterprise can efficiently develop a solid base of references, collateral, and internal procedures and documentation by virtue of a restricted set of market variables. The efficiency of the marketing process, at this point, is a function of the boundedness of the market segment being addressed. The more tightly bound it is, the easier it is to create and introduce messages into it, and the faster these messages travel by word of mouth. Companies just starting out, as well as any marketing program operating with scarce resources, must operate in a tightly bound market to be competitive. Otherwise, their hot marketing messages get diffused too early. The chain reaction of word-of-mouth communication dies out, and the sales force is back to selling cold. This is a classic chasm symptom, as the enterprise leaves behind the niche represented by the early market. It is usually interpreted as a letdown in the sales force, or a cooling off in demand, when in fact, it is simply the consequence of trying to expand into too loosely bounded a market. The D-Day strategy prevents this mistake. It has the ability to galvanize an entire enterprise by focusing it on a highly specific goal that is, one, readily achievable, and two, capable of being directly leveraged into long-term success. Most companies fail to cross the chasm because, confronted with the immensity of opportunity represented by a mainstream market, they lose their focus, chasing every opportunity that presents itself, but finding themselves unable to deliver a saleable proposition to any true pragmatist buyer. The D-Day strategy keeps everyone on point. If we don't take Normandy, we don't have to worry about how we're going to take Paris. And by focusing our entire might on such a small territory, we greatly increase our odds of immediate success. Unfortunately, sound as this strategy is, it is counterintuitive to the management of startup enterprises. And thus, although widely acknowledged in theory, it is rarely put into practice. Here's the more common scenario. How to start a fire. Starting a fire is a problem that any Boy Scout or Girl Scout can solve. You lay down some bunched up newspaper, put on some kindling and some logs, and then light the paper. Nothing could be easier. Trying to cross the chasm without taking a niche market approach is like trying to light a fire without kindling. The bunched up paper represents your promotional budget, and the log, a major market opportunity. No matter how much paper you put under that log, if you don't have any target market segments to act as kindling, sooner or later, the paper will be all used up, and the log still won't be burning. When the pen-based computer came out, companies like Go and Momenta burned their way through tens of millions of dollars in marketing to absolutely no avail. This was a very expensive lesson in scouting. This isn't rocket science, but it does represent a kind of discipline. And it is here that high-tech management shows itself most lacking. Most high-tech leaders, when it comes down to making marketing choices, will continue to shy away from making niche commitments, regardless. Like marriage-averse bachelors, They may nod in all the right places and say all the right things, but they will not show up when the wedding bells chime. Why not? First, let us understand that this is a failure of will, not of understanding. That is, it is not that these leaders need to learn about niche marketing. MBA marketing curricula of the past 25 years have been adamant about the need to segment markets and the advantages gained thereby. No one, therefore, can or does plead ignorance. Instead, the claim is made that although niche strategy is generally best, we do not have time, or we cannot afford, to implement it now. This is a ruse, of course, the true answer being much simpler. We do not have, nor are we willing to adopt, any discipline that would ever require us to stop pursuing any sale at any time for any reason. We are, in other words, not a market-driven company. We are a sales-driven company. Now, how bad can this really be? I mean, sales are good, right? Surely things can just work themselves out, and we will discover our market, albeit retroactively, led to it by our customers, yes? The true answers to the previous three questions are 1. Disastrous, 2. Not always, and 3. Never in a million years. The consequences of being sales-driven during the chasm period are, to put it simply, fatal. Here's why. The sole goal of the company during this stage of market development must be to secure a beachhead in a mainstream market. That is, to create a pragmatist customer base that is referenceable. People who can, in turn, provide us access to other mainstream prospects. To capture this reference base, we must ensure that our first set of customers completely satisfy their buying objectives. To do that, we must ensure that the customer gets not just the product, but what we will describe in a later chapter as the whole product, the complete set of products and services needed to achieve the desired result. Whenever anything is left out from this set, the solution is incomplete, the selling promise unfulfilled, and the customer unavailable for referencing. Therefore, to secure these much-needed references, which is our prime goal in crossing the chasm, we must commit ourselves to providing, or at least guaranteeing the provision of, the whole product. Whole product commitments, however, are expensive. Even when we recruit partners and allies to help fulfill them, they require resource-intensive management. And when the support role falls back on us, it often requires the attention of our most key people, the same people who are critical to every other project we have going. Therefore, whole product commitments must be made not only sparingly, but strategically. That is, made with a view toward leveraging them over multiple sales. This can only happen if the sales effort is focused on one or two niche markets. More than that, and you burn out your key resources, falter on the quality of your whole product commitment, and prolong your stay in the chasm. To be truly sales-driven is to invite a permanent stay. For reasons of whole product leverage alone, the sales-driven strategy should be avoided, but its siren lure is so strong that additional ammunition against it is warranted. Consider the following. One of the keys in breaking into a new market is to establish a strong word-of-mouth reputation among buyers. Numerous studies have shown that in the high-tech buying process, word of mouth is the number one source of information buyers reference, both at the beginning of the sales cycle to establish their long lists, and at the end when they are paring down their short ones. Now, for word of mouth to develop in any particular marketplace, there must be a critical mass of informed individuals who meet from time to time, and, in exchanging views, reinforce the product's or the company's positioning. That's how word of mouth spreads. Seeding this communications process is expensive, particularly once you leave the early market, which in general can be reached through the technical press and related media, and make the transition into the mainstream market. Pragmatist buyers, as we have already noted, communicate along industry lines or through professional associations. Chemists talk to other chemists, lawyers to other lawyers, insurance executives to other insurance executives, and so on. Winning over one or two customers in each of 5 or 10 different segments, the consequence of taking a sales-driven approach, will create no word-of-mouth effect. Your customers may try to start a conversation about you, but there will be no one there to reinforce it. By contrast, winning 4 or 5 customers in one segment will create the desired effect. Thus, the segment targeting company can expect word-of-mouth leverage early in its crossing the chasm marketing effort, whereas the sales-driven company will get it much later, if at all. This lack of word-of-mouth, in turn, makes selling the product that much harder, thereby adding to the cost and the unpredictability of sales. Finally, there is a third compelling reason to be niche-focused when crossing the chasm, which has to do with the need to achieve market leadership. Pragmatist customers want to buy from market leaders. Their motive is simple. Whole products grow up around the market-leading products and not around the others. That is, there are many more books about how to use Intuit's Quicken, many more Quicken-compatible programs, many more Quicken templates, many more directly accessible data sources through Quicken than with Microsoft's money. The existence of this added value infrastructure not only enriches the value of the product, but also simplifies the task of getting support. Pragmatists are very much aware of this effect. They do not want to get caught owning a 3DO instead of a Sony PlayStation, an OS 2 server instead of Windows NT, or a Progress database instead of an Oracle. Therefore, they perhaps unconsciously but nonetheless consistently conspire to install some company or product as the market leader and then do everything in their power to keep them there. One of the main reasons they delay their buying decisions at the beginning of a marketplace, thereby creating the chasm effect, is to help them get a fix on who the leader will be. They don't want to back the wrong one. Now, by definition, when you are crossing the chasm, you are not a market leader. The question is, how can you accelerate achieving that state? This is a matter of simple mathematics. To be the leader in any given market, you need the largest market share, typically over 50% at the beginning of a market, although it may end up to be as little as 30 to 35% later on. So, take the sales you expect to generate over any given time period, say the next 2 years, double that number, and that's the size of market you can expect to dominate. Actually, to be precise, that is the maximum size of market, because the calculation assumes that all your sales came from a single market segment. So, if we want market leadership early on, and we do, since we know pragmatists tend to buy from market leaders, and our number one marketing goal is to achieve a pragmatist installed base that can be referenced, the only right strategy is to take a big fish, small pond approach. Segment, segment, segment. One of the other benefits of this approach is that it leads directly to you owning a market. That is, you get installed by the pragmatists as the leader, and from then on, they conspire to help keep you there. This means that there are significant barriers to entry for any competitors, regardless of their size or the added features they have in their product. Mainstream customers will, to be sure, complain about your lack of features and insist you upgrade to meet the competition. But in truth, mainstream customers like to be owned. It simplifies their buying decisions, improves the quality, and lowers the cost of whole product ownership, and provides security that the vendor is here to stay. They demand attention, but they are on your side. As a result, an owned market can take on some of the characteristics of an annuity, a building block in good times, and a place of refuge in bad. With far more predictable revenues and far lower cost of sales than can otherwise be achieved. For all these reasons, for whole product leverage, for word-of-mouth effectiveness, and for perceived market leadership, it is critical that, when crossing the chasm, you focus exclusively on achieving a dominant position in one or two narrowly bounded market segments. If you do not commit fully to this goal, the odds are overwhelmingly against your ever arriving in the mainstream market. What about Microsoft? Let me admit from the outset that, to the best of my knowledge, Microsoft has never followed the niche strategy that I have been so strongly advocating. It has not been a practitioner of the D-Day approach. Instead, it has continually taken what might be called the Evel Knievel approach. Ignore the chasm. So how in the world has it been so successful? And why wouldn't anybody with a grain of sense follow their model, Mr. Moore, instead of yours? Here I think we have an example of the legal profession's notion that great cases make bad law. Microsoft's history is so unique, it makes it virtually unusable as a precedent for strategy decisions in other companies. All three of its primary technologies, Windows, NT, and Internet Explorer, have been direct extensions of a PC operating system franchise that Microsoft inherited and then stole from IBM. That act of theft was Promethean, the stealing of fire from the gods and giving it to humans. It was not dishonest. It was brilliant. But the key point here is, Microsoft, from day one, was operating in a context of being a de facto standard. It was born inside a tornado of demand that IBM created, and all its subsequent acts of market development have been based on being the rich heir to that estate. That status has allowed Microsoft to co-opt new technologies, rather than have to introduce them directly. Its success, in other words, has been based primarily on being a fast follower of technologies introduced first by others. This is clearly true both for Windows, which was derived directly from the Macintosh, and the Internet Explorer, derived directly from Netscape Navigator. And I think the same could be argued for Windows NT, whose claim to fame is not that it pushes the state-of-the-art of operating systems forward, but rather that it is a truly common standard platform, the real fulfillment of the empty promise of Unix. The point here is not to deride Microsoft's technological skills, but rather to celebrate its market development strategy. As owner of all the clients in a client-server world, it has a permanent enclave on the pragmatist side of the chasm. It controls the gates to the city. When barbarians show up with their discontinuous innovations, it can shut the gates. When it shows up with its own versions of the same, it can open the gates. It's gates. And it's a very lucrative franchise indeed. What it is not is a good precedent for the rest of us. Whereas Microsoft can work both sides of the chasm, as it were, most other companies have to cross without help. Indeed, often they have to cross in the teeth of Microsoft's resistance. Entering the mainstream market is an act of burglary, of breaking and entering, of deception, often even of stealth. Mapping out a global assault plan, attacking all fronts at once, may work for massively intimidating market leaders who already have troops in place throughout the world, but it is just plain silly for stripling challengers. Instead, we need to pick our spots carefully, attack fiercely, and then dig in and hold. Beyond niches. Now, having said all that, we need also to acknowledge that there is life after niche. Major market dominance ultimately transcends niche, although it continues to renew and extend itself by developing new segments. And this is indeed when the truly large profits are made. It is clearly a post-chasm phenomenon, but there is a planning exercise to be done from the outset. Just as the objective of D-Day was to take Normandy beaches, but the goal was to liberate France, so in our marketing strategy, we want to establish a longer-term vision to guide our immediate tactical choices. The key to moving beyond one's initial target niche is to select strategic target market segments to begin with. That is, target a segment that, by virtue of its other connections, creates an entry point into a larger segment. For example, when the Macintosh crossed the chasm, the target niche was the graphics arts department in Fortune 500 companies. This was not a particularly large target market, but it was one that was responsible for a broken, mission-critical process, providing presentations for executives and marketing professionals. The fact that the segment was relatively small turned out to be good news, because Apple was able to dominate it quickly and establish its proprietary system as a legitimate standard within the corporation, against the wishes of the MIS department, which wanted everyone on an IBM PC. More importantly, however, having dominated this niche, the company was then able to leverage its win into adjacent departments within the corporation. First marketing, then sales. The marketing people found that if they made their own presentations, they could update them on the way to the trade shows, and the salespeople found that with a Mac, they didn't have to rely on the marketing people. At the same time, this beachhead in graphics arts also extended out into external markets that interfaced with the graphics arts people, creative agencies, advertising agencies, and eventually publishers. All used the Macintosh to exchange a variety of graphic materials, and the result was a complete ecosystem standardized on the non-standard platform. How to ensure that one selects a strategic niche for the D-Day landing site is the subject of the next chapter. Before moving on to it, however, let's take a look at some highly visible companies who successfully implemented a highly focused approach to crossing the chasm. Successful chasm crossings. Footnote. This is one of two sections in this book that has been significantly rewritten from the ground up. In the original, I made a distinction between two forms of niche marketing, application niches and thematic niches. Subsequent experience proved that there was no such thing as a thematic niche. Instead, the idea anticipated what I came to call the tornado, a mass market phase of the technology adoption lifecycle that follows the bowling alley, and which became the subject of my second book, Inside the Tornado. End footnote. In the paragraphs that follow, we will look at four successful chasm crossings, two by applications vendors, Clarify and Documentum, and two by platform vendors, Palm Pilot and Neon, New Era of Networks. All four fought off major competition to gain dominant shares of mainstream market niches, and each was able to parlay that into strong equity returns for its investors. But the challenges for platform companies, we shall see, are very different than those facing application companies. Applications are naturally vertical because they directly interface with end users. And end users organize themselves by geography, industry, and profession. This makes them readily adaptable to the beachhead focus needed to cross the chasm. Later on in the life cycle, however, as solutions generalize, mass marketing rewards more of a one-size-fits-all offer. But being tied to end users makes this much harder for an application offer to support. By contrast, platforms have just the opposite dynamic. They are naturally horizontal because they interface with machines and other programs where the value, in part, is providing a stable, standard interface. They do not lend themselves to vertical marketing because, as products, they do not change very much from niche to niche. Unfortunately, however, pragmatist customers rarely adopt any new technology en masse. Usually, these innovations are taken up first by a single niche, one that has such pressing problems it goes ahead of the herd. The rest of the herd is delighted by the eventuality because it gets a free look at how well the technology plays out without having to take any immediate risk. The niche wins, presuming the beachhead strategy is conducted correctly, by getting a fix for its specialized problem. And the vendor wins because it gets certified by at least one group of pragmatists that its offering is mainstream. So because of the dynamics of technology adoption, and not because of any niche properties in the product itself, platforms must take a vertical market approach to crossing the chasm, even though it seems unnatural. The good news for them is that later on, when a mass market emerges, it is much easier for the platform vendor to take advantage of the opportunity. Clarify. A customer service application crosses the chasm. In the early 1990s, as client-server architecture was crossing the chasm, Clarify developed its flagship application, Clear Support, a software system to improve the productivity of customer service representatives working over the phone. The product was unusual in that it built a picture of each customer interaction around the intersection of three elements: the customer calling, the product that caused the call, and the knowledge that had to be pulled together to solve the customer's problem. This allowed companies using the product to track their customer relationships, identify their problem products, and capture the troubleshooting learning for reuse in future calls. The customer's problem was assured high visibility by the device of a trouble ticket, or case, that was routed and tracked through the organization until the complaint was resolved. It was, and indeed still is, a great idea, but it required not only new software and significant systems re-engineering, but also new workflows and new job descriptions, and pragmatists were leery of jumping on board. There were, however, visionaries who saw in the system a chance to gain a competitive advantage through more responsive service transactions and the opportunity to build long-term relationships with valued customers. The earliest adopters were network hardware systems vendors whose customers always had major challenges during systems integration. Another early adopting segment was medical equipment vendors, where the complexity of installation again drove service demands beyond what a normal process could handle. Then there were customers in financial services, offering call centers to their high net worth customers, and others in telecommunications, handling complaints and dispatching field service representatives, and still others in high tech, helping their customers and resellers work through all the complexities and bugs in their new products. One of these last was Cisco Systems, which was emerging at that time as a major player in the network hardware market. Their implementation caught the attention both of their customers and their competitors. Everyone in the industry, vendors, resellers, and customers, was struggling with the increasing severity of the customer support problem, in part because systems in themselves were becoming more complex, and in part because they began to interoperate more and more with other systems, creating even more complexity. The market was exploding, and lack of customer support threatened to become a bottleneck to growth. People simply could not hire enough support people or train them fast enough. As a result, there emerged a niche-wide demand for technology to help solve these problems. This is an example of how a vertical market with a broken mission-critical process creates an attractive beachhead opportunity. No longer does the market present itself customer by customer. Now, it presents an opportunity to go after a whole segment as one. But there is a price to pay here. The segment has specific needs that weren't prioritized. And these priorities, at minimum, compete with, and sometimes even directly conflict with, the desires of customers in other markets. What is a company to do in this case? The answer when crossing the chasm is clear. Make a total commitment to the niche, and then do your best to meet everyone else's needs with whatever resources you have left over. In the case of Clarify, it made a total commitment to the network hardware companies, winning in short order other key market leaders like Wellfleet, 3Com, and Synoptics, which then gave it the credibility to win additional lesser-known companies. These customers, first and foremost, wanted case routing that interfaced with their development organization's bug reporting applications to ensure that bugs were trapped, tagged, and tracked through to elimination. They also wanted knowledge bases that could capture for reuse highly complex technical knowledge. These were two of the key needs that Clarify prioritized above all their other requests to ensure they help these customers be successful across the niche. Winning the network hardware niche allowed the company to leverage itself into an adjacent niche, computer software and systems, where it was able to garner major customers like Microsoft. The customer problems here were not quite as complex, but the call volumes were in many cases much higher. Success in computers was subsequently leveraged into telecommunications, where a new demand emerged, the desire to turn a customer service call into a selling opportunity. This led to the emergence of a second product line called Clear Call Center. That product, in turn, has proved of real interest to the financial services community. And so it goes. Winning the beachhead, knocking over the head pin, creates a dynamic of follow-on adoption, opening up new market opportunities, in part from leveraging a solution from one niche to another, in part from word-of-mouth interaction between customers in the adjacent niches. It worked for Clarify, just as it worked for the company to which we will turn next. Documentum, a document management application, crosses the chasm. In 1993, when Jeff Miller took over the reins at Documentum, the company, despite inheriting a wealth of document management technology for free when it spun out of Xerox, had gone through three straight years of flat revenues in the $2 million range. This is a classic performance for a company whose market is in the chasm. In the year after Jeff came on board, it went to $8 million, then to $25 million, then $45 million, and an IPO, and then $75 million. That is world-class chasm crossing. What did Jeff and his team do? Actually, they took the original edition of Crossing the Chasm and made it their market development blueprint. Knowing that they were in the chasm, and knowing that the first key to getting out was to select a beachhead market segment, they surveyed their client experience to date and targeted a very thin market niche, the regulatory affairs department in Fortune 500 pharmaceutical companies. Now, there are only about 40 of these in the whole world, and the largest is a few dozen people or so. So how could a company justify reducing its market scope from all personnel who touch complex documents in all large enterprises to maybe 1,000 people total on the planet? The answer is that when you are picking a chasm-crossing target, it is not about the number of people involved. It is about the amount of pain they are causing. In the case of the pharmaceutical industry's regulatory affairs function, the pain was excruciating. This is the group that has to get the new drug approval application submitted to the 100 or so different regulatory bodies around the world. The process does not start until patents are awarded. The patents have a 17-year life, and a successful patented drug generates on average about $400 million per year. Once the drug goes off patent, however, its economic returns plummet. Every day spent in the application process is a day of patent life wasted. Pharmaceutical companies were taking up to 1 year to get their first application filed. Not a year to get it approved, a year to get it submitted. That was because applications range from 250 to 500,000 pages in length and come from a myriad of sources. Clinical trial studies, correspondence, manufacturing databases, the patent office, research lab notebooks, and the like. All this material has to be frozen in time as a master copy, against which all subsequent changes in information are posted and tracked. It is a nightmare of a problem, and it was costing the drug companies big bucks. By tackling this problem, Documentum ensured itself of a strongly committed customer. The commitment did not come from the IT organization, which pragmatically was content to work with its established vendors, making continuous improvements to the existing document management infrastructure. Instead, it came from the top brass, who, seeing in Documentum a chance to re-engineer the entire process to a very different new end, overruled the in-house folks and demanded that they support the new paradigm. This is a standard pattern in crossing the chasm. It is normally the departmental function who leads. They have the problem. The executive function, who prioritizes, the problem is causing enterprise-wide grief, and the technical function that follows. They have to make the new stuff work while still maintaining all the old stuff. In a year, Documentum had demonstrated that it could solve this problem, and some 30 of the top 40 companies had committed to its solution. That is what drove its sales to $8 million and then to $25 million. But the revenue since then has come from the bowling pin effect of niche marketing. Inside the drug companies, Documentum became the standard for all document management tasks. So it spread from the regulatory affairs group to the researchers to the manufacturing floor. Once it got to the floor, the plant construction and maintenance contractors, who were using it to assemble and maintain documentation on all the systems and procedures in the factory, recognized that factories in related process industries had the same needs, and they took the product into regulated chemicals, non-regulated chemicals, and oil refineries. When the product hit the refineries, what people in the oil industry call the downstream part of their business, the IT people recognized a tool that could solve a major problem in their upstream business, exploration and production. Their key concern is the management of leasable properties, what's available, what's under contract, who else is involved, etc. It is a rat's nest of interrelated contingencies. And without a document management system, it was being managed largely by word of mouth and paper files. Enter Documentum for another major success. And then that success caught the attention of Wall Street, who saw that the same facilities would help them get better control over their swaps and derivatives business. And that is pretty much the chain of events that had taken Documentum to over $100 million in revenues. It is niche marketing at its most leveraged. There are two keys to this entire sequence. The first is knocking over the headpin, taking the beachhead, crossing the chasm. The size of the first pin is not the issue, but the economic value of the problem it fixes is. The more serious the problem, the faster the target niche will pull you out of the chasm. Once out, your opportunities to expand into other niches are immensely increased, because now, having one set of customers solidly behind you, you are much less risky to back as a new vendor. The second key is to have lined up other market segments into which you can leverage your initial niche solution. This allows you to reinterpret the financial gain in crossing the chasm. It is not about the money you make from the first niche. It is the sum of that money plus the gains from all subsequent niches. It is a bowling alley estimate, not just a headpin estimate, that should drive the calculation of gain. This is a particularly important point for entrepreneurs working inside large corporations or having to compete for funding against larger, more established market opportunities. If the executive council cannot see the extended market, if they only see the first niche, they won't fund. Conversely, if you go the other way and show them only an aggregated mass market, the end result of the market going horizontal and into hypergrowth, they will fund, but then they will fire you as you fail to generate these spectacular numbers quickly. The bowling pin model allows you both to focus on the immediate market, keeping the burn rate down and the market development effort targeted, while still keeping in view the larger win. 3Com Palm Pilot, a standalone platform, crosses the chasm. Usually when companies struggle with crossing the chasm, it stems from the inability to call out and commit to a single target customer. After all, sales are tight, and restricting the field seems counterintuitive at best. But occasionally, the target customer has already been picked, and still the industry flails about. This was the case when it came to the PDA, personal digital assistant market, which struggled for a number of years in the chasm before Palm Computing, later acquired by U.S. Robotics, later acquired by 3Com, came out with the Palm Pilot and brought the category into the mainstream market. What did they do right that everyone else before them did wrong? The beachhead target market for PDAs was the management team of high-tech enterprises who spent 100% of their time either in meetings or on the road. In both situations, they need support for contact applications, telephone and email, and for setting up more meetings, calendar. Paper systems have lots of pluses here, but a huge downside in being hard to update and hard to coordinate among individuals. Software can solve the first problem easily, and the second problem with difficulty. Given that the target market is predisposed to high tech, there is definitely a compelling reason to buy. The first wave of entrants into this market came from the consumer electronics space, the Sharp Wizard and the Casio Boss. These products were priced right, but were too limited in functionality. They had no calendars at all, and their phone books initially were manual input only, with no backup. You only had to lose one to never play that game again. This led the market to look toward a more PC-oriented solution. The market had already seen palm-top PCs from Cyan and Pocket, neither of which had won enough adherence to be interesting. The next wave of offers came from two major PC players, Hewlett-Packard, with its LX line of palm-top computers, and Apple, with its Newton. Each had a clear shot at the market, and each organization missed. How they missed is particularly instructive. HP could not let go of the PC. The 95LX had a phone list and a calendar that met a first approximation of the market requirements. Its problem was that it also ran DOS, Lotus 1-2-3, and a word processor. It had a full keyboard, provided you had fingers no broader than a pencil, and PCMCIA slots, and RAM, and. And it also cost $695. In sum, it was neither fish nor fowl. And the market, other than HP employees, said no thank you. Newton was never a PC. Apple's problem was they could not let go of the vision. John Sculley had sponsored the Knowledge Navigator vision in a compelling video that had everybody's enthusiastic buy-in. Newton was held hostage to that video. A Knowledge Navigator it wasn't, however, and more importantly, no one was asking to buy such a thing anyway. As a palm top, Newton also met the minimum spec for phonebook and calendaring applications. But its form factor simply was too far off of spec. It was more like a brick than a deck of cards. Moreover, coordinating calendars in a Microsoft world was not on. But most importantly, it had hyped its pen recognition software, which performed so badly in the real world, it became the subject of a series of Doonesbury cartoons. The Palm Pilot team, headed by Jeff Hawkins on the technical side and Donna Dublinsky on the business side, had the advantage of seeing a lot of things not work. But to their credit, they had the gumption to pick a focus and stick to it. The result was a truly compelling consumer product. The form factor fit in a breast pocket, obsoleting the pocket protector whose space and role it preempted. The application interface was intuitive to anyone who had ever used a Mac or Windows PC, the entirety of the target market. It had a hugely convenient docking station that facilitated upload-download to manage phone numbers and held out the promise of coordinating calendars. The world needed first to decide what calendaring system it would standardize on, and then develop the behaviors and processes to support the effort, a work that is still in progress. It used a pen in a way that was restricted enough to actually work, and it met the consumer price point of being under $400. And that was it. People loved this thing. The technology industry management teams took the lead on it, but pretty quickly it was getting passed around to the rest of us, and the passion did not abate. It is one of the few products after the Mac that has been able to create passion among a broad class of users. Why? Because it just nailed the problem these folks have. Success through subtraction is the key lesson here. And that subtraction was made possible by a vote of confidence in design aesthetics and in target marketing. By contrast, the companies who failed had over-designed for the target market because they were hedging their bets. Ironically, in the act of trying to reduce their market risk, they actually increased it. Companies who cannot commit to a single chasm-crossing target almost always fall prey to this mistake. For application companies, making this commitment is hard. But for platform companies, it is even harder. Platforms, by their very nature, pay off when they achieve ubiquity, and typically not before. So the investors are rarely enthusiastic about any niche strategy. Moreover, the R&D folks, looking ahead to the full charter, start to build in placeholders for the full array of supported features. And the sales folks, surveying the early opportunities and liking to have their own turf, each march off in separate directions. It's a huge challenge to manage. The Palm Pilot has subsequently converted itself from a closed appliance, like the Macintosh, to an open platform, like the PC, which the company calls the Palm 3. It is doing so under relentless attack from Microsoft's Windows CE platform, which has launched a Palm PC directly at its flagship offer. The Palm 3, for example, has incorporated wireless modems and software programs to enable email and internet access applications, and the company is actively recruiting developers to extend it further. Here, their Java software development kit and their support for a PC standard serial port interface should help a great deal. Moreover, there are convergence offers emerging, including the melding of a Palm 3 with a cell phone. Nonetheless, this is a game that Microsoft plays exceptionally well, and gaining ubiquity when playing against an entrenched incumbent is painfully hard. Moreover, increased focus on the platform adds complexity to the delivered system, thereby detracting from the original value proposition. This is okay for advanced Palm Pilot users, but bad for new ones. And so the company has also released a Palm 5, which celebrates the initial vision by being even thinner and sleeker. This jewel even won over a diehard conservative like myself. By splitting the product line, Palm is able to explore two avenues at once. It is beyond the scope of this book to talk about post-chasm market development. For that, the reader is referred to a sequel, Inside the Tornado. But we will have occasion to comment further on its challenges after we take a look at one more platform play. Smart Cards, a distributed platform, crosses the chasm. Remember when VCRs came on the market? Okay, I am older than you. Anyway, the issue then was that VCR manufacturers complained that they would sell more machines if only there were more videotapes to show on them. And the film industry said they would make more videotapes if only there were more machines in circulation to view them. This led to a prolonged period of discomfort, not unlike what happened at the advent of the smart card. Smart cards look like credit cards into which have been embedded chips. In the simplest case, these are memory chips which can record cash values along with other identifying information. In more complex forms, they include microprocessors, allowing them, for example, to participate as clients in client-server security applications. All smart cards require a smart card reader to be activated. Most are contact-based. Think of an automated teller machine at a bank, although in the United States the cards are all magnetic strip, not smart. But some are contactless, as in the toll collection systems in, say, Singapore. Smart cards are a hugely compelling platform to visionaries. Visionary marketers see in them the opportunity to create loyalty programs, frequent flyer miles, frequent shopper cards. Universities see them as a security ID and a debit card. And the internet community sees them as part of a universal PKI, public key infrastructure, security system. All these applications require smart card readers, and there is no end to their uses, if the readers are ubiquitous. If, however, the density of readers is sparse, so that a backup system is also required, then most of the value proposition evaporates. And that, achieving density or critical mass, is the key to crossing the adoption chasm with any platform. The market leader in smart cards is Gem Plus, with, as the century comes to a close, something like 80% market share worldwide. Almost none of that share, interestingly, comes from the United States. Why? Well, let's look where it does come from and see if we can't see the pattern. The first major take-up of smart